starting the recorders. You're starting. All right.
Don't have it started.
So today is April 21st, 2018. I'm Amanda Hardiman. I'm here with Eric Griffiths and Adam Watson's outside, and we're here to interview Jewel Dixie at his home in Chattahoochee. And we're going to talk about some of his experiences throughout his life and farming and anything else you want to talk about. So, Mr. Dixie, can you start out by giving me your name and date of birth?
My name is Jewel Jerome Dixie. I was born November 8th, 1938, in Gadsden County on the east side on the Woodbury Farm. Which was known as the Dog Town Community.
I was going to say when we're walking around, it's making the cameras move. So.
Okay.
Like I'm trying to move any because it's making a problem.
Pull up a chair.
Well, that's all right.
Okay.
Letting you know.
Why'd they call it Dog Town?
Well, I don't know. That's the name I always heard. They call it the Dogtown Community. Now, why they call it that, I really don't know.
All right. So, can you tell me about what it was like growing up there?
Well, growing up, for it all concerned, it was a sweet life. We lived out on the farm. Mother and father, they took us to church. They took us to work. And they sent us to school. Money was scarce, but food was plentiful because they raised the food. We had plenty of chicken, Guinness, we raised turkeys and hogs. At the time, he was later on in life before we went to having cattle. But other than that, food, there was never a shortage of food. They grow cane, and my daddy made syrup out there on the farm, and he did all the cooking of the syrup. It was three or four people down the farm sharecropping, but he did all the cooking of the syrup, and then everybody got their part. But food was plentiful, and the people, they worked together, and for all I was concerned, it was a sweet life. Wasn't a whole lot of money, but it was a sweet life, and a few people was able to accumulate. Them that would get out there and work and took advantage of it and didn't waste away, they was able to save a few nickels. It wasn't no big money, but they was able to save a few nickels. I see in my younger life, that was a time when they had stamps. And they had stamps to get gas, sugar, such kind of clothes. So a lot of times, hey, if a person needed shoes and didn't have a stamp, maybe somebody else had a shoe stamp, they'll swap. And sometimes people got stamped to get gas, but they didn't have no car. So, hey, they would swap their stamp. And, hey, people, it was tough. But if people managed, they survived. And they did all right. But now you had to be careful. And,
You said your family had hogs and turkeys and all that?
Had hogs, turkeys.
Was that just for you all, or did they sell? And?
Oh, we raised them, we ate them. Wasn't too much selling, it was mostly like swapping back then. Now the hogs, they sold them to the market. And the syrup, when they made syrup, that was sold to the market. And that was most how they got their money, from like the hog, the syrup. And at that time, they were sharecropping what they called sun tobacco. At that time, they didn't have the shades. They were growing tobacco out in the sun. And on the few places they were living, they would plant the crop. They would take care of the crop. And they would do all the work. And then they got, I think, and most of the time, when the farmer furnished everything, the people that did the work, they got the fourth. He furnished the land, the fertilizer, the seeds, and everything. And then you were living in this house, on this place, and he'll give you the fourth.
That's like sharecropping.
Yeah, that's what they call sharecropping, yes. Mm-hmm.
And that's what your family did?
That's what they did. They did that. I think we moved off the farm. I can't be for sure, but I was in the first grade, so he was about 44 or 45 when my father quit sharecropping. Then he moved to Quincy. He went to work at the Florida mine, and he had a mule and a wagon, and he, Ryan Quincy, some people might have an acre or two, and he'll rent, or he'll grow for stuff out there on their property, because a lot of it they weren't using. He'll grow stuff out there and give them so much, and he did that for years. As I got to be like 9 and 10 years old, hey, I learned how to ply, and I'd be out there. I had a brother with him. He died in 59, but I had a brother. We'd be out there helping him, and we raised vegetables.
When did you start doing chores on the farm? How young were you?
Oh, shoot. We were going to the field. Hey, we were going to the field maybe 4 or 5 years old. Wasn't that much work we were doing, but hey, when they went to the field, wasn't nobody at the house to keep us, so we went out there to field with them, you know, and did whatever they, or maybe a little some of whatever they showed us to do, and all, pull some grass or whatever. Might not have did nothing slept, but we was out there with them, but wasn't nobody at the house to keep us, because all of them was out there in the field. They was working, so we was right out there with them.
Wow, so it was a part of your life, like every day.
Oh, yeah, that was a part of my life. And I know when I was in the first grade, I know I was doing pretty good with chores then, because, feeding the chickens. And most of the time, I had to go to the spring, get water. And the spring usually was always down the hill. And had to go down there and get water, bring it to the house. And what made it so bad, it would take a long time for your lunch. A lot of times you might have two small buckets that help balance you. But when it was raining and wet, you would have to try to cover the hill with both buckets, and then you'd raise both of them until you learn how to, get one and take it up the hill and go back and get the other when it was wet weather so you can get to the house with some water. You know, there was small children, we would have gallon buckets. But then, like my bigger sister and brother, their buckets, I think, would be like 2.5 gallon buckets. But we would have a gallon bucket. Everybody trying to bring a little water to the house. That was just for the drinking water. Because now, the water like for bathing and washing their clothes, a lot of times they had a place down at the spring where they could wash their clothes. And you wouldn't have to carry the water for them. But they always had barrels at the house where you'd catch rainwater, and they could use that for mopping and bathing or whatever. And everybody pulled together. Everybody had chores to do. The sisters, they most helped mother in the house, cleaning the house, preparing the food. And me and my brother, our job was, to keep the wood in the house. We had wooden stoves. So during the summer, all we had to do was get wood for the stove. But in the wintertime, we warmed with wood too. So we'd have to get the firewood for the fireplace and the stove wood inside the house. Because we'd go in the woods and they'd cut the trees, had a cross-cut saw, and split it. We'd bring it to the house on the wagon, but then we'd have to make sure we had wood in the house for cooking and for heating. And it was just it was kind of like a well-oiled machine with everybody pulled their part. Because my sisters, they would help my mother cook and clean the house. My mother could sew, and a lot of our clothes, she made them. And like during them time, you got your meal, not the meal, the flour they got in bags. And she would take them clothes bags and make the girls blouses, make us some shirts. And people would give them to them. And she did that for years. She sewed on her hand and made a lot of clothes. And it was just, everybody worked together. And even the people in the community worked together. Just like when they went to get in the car, they were a milk car. So, hey, if our car had a calf, we were getting milk, then we were sharing with other people. And then their calf come fresh. That way we go all around the community. Then they'll share milk with you. And when this family killed hogs, the people in the community come help you kill your hogs, and you share some meat with them. Then when they kill hogs, they'll share meat with you. And then they put it in the smoke house, they cured the meat out, they made the sausage. Well, hey, we would kill a hog, say, in November or December, but then we'd have meat till next year. And just like most time, they would start grinding cane. They would start stripping cane. Ooh, look like to me, just before November, they'll start stripping it. And I can't remember exactly how long it would be before they'll start making syrup. But then sometimes they'll make syrup on the December. And sometimes, if they were finished, they would even make it even after Christmas till they finished up all the syrup. And one of the big things about that before, if they were going to start cooking syrup like that Saturday morning, they would kill a hog that Friday. So then that Saturday morning, they start the cooking syrup. And it'll take about 4 hours. If they start at about 6 o'clock, it was going to be about 10 or 11 o'clock. Before the first syrup came off, or then they was cooking on a kiln. And they wanted to have some fresh meat. So hey, everybody could buy some, what they call a tenderloin off the hog. They'd have some tenderloin, they'd have them good fresh biscuits and some syrup. And hey, everybody be around there to taste it and eat some. And it was just a community thing. And it was part of life, and everybody would be there, help. Somebody had to feed the meal, and somebody had to bring the cane up there to the meal, and it was just all teamwork, and people went together. Mm-hmm. And at that time, when it first started, it was cooking on a kiln. There was a big round metal thing, and some of them was like 80 gallons or 100 gallons. Some of them had like 150 gallon kiln. But then in a few years, they went to evaporator. That was a long triangle thing. It was about 3 feet wide. And some of them be like 12, 14, or 16 feet long. But it had different sections in the trough. And the canned juice would go in it on this end. And you fired it from this end. And as you cooked it, it would go down there. Through them different troughs, it'll just move through the section. And when it come out the other end, it will serve it. And it'll take a good while, you know, from the juice going here. And you get it full up. And then it will set to take boiled and cook down the syrup. It'll take about maybe, once you fire that evaporator up, it'll probably take about 2 hours for you on the other end where you open it up. And finally, you start syrup coming out there. Then it was a continuous thing. Syrup would be coming out on the far end, and juice would be going out on this end. Juice would be going in on this end. And then it had side troughs on each side. An evaporator, it didn't work as hard because it did a lot of self-skimming. As it boiled up, it would go to the side, and then a lot of trash would run back there, and you just had a little narrow scoop. You'd scoop that, and you'd get a lot of the trash that was in the syrup. And when it, excuse me, when the suet come out on the other end, it was clear and very, very, very little trash was left in it. The evaporator did a much better job than the kiln did. The suet would be lighter and it would be more cleaner.
When did you have the evaporator? When did that come?
Oh, they started cooking on the evaporators. It was in the 40s. I can't remember exactly what year. But you know, when they went to evaporate, that mean it took more juice with an evaporator. It had to be a constant thing because the juice was sturdy. And then for a small amount of can, you wouldn't even want a 5 evaporator because it took a good while. But for a kiln, see, like with a kiln, hey, you could put whatever you wanted. If you didn't have a, you could have a 100-gallon kiln, but if you didn't have a 50-gallon of juice, you could put it in there because you fired the kiln from the bottom. And as it boiled up, all the water would boil out, and then you would skim it. And when you got through it, it'd take about, hey, 3 to 4 hours. And if you had about 50 gallons of juice, but when you got through cooking it, it all depends on the content of the sweetness, sugar content in it. But it took, most time it took like from 8 to 10 gallons of juice to make 1 gallon of syrup. And a lot of people, when my dad was cooking syrup for people, and he said a lot of time it'll be so disappointing, they'll bring a lot of jugs like they were gonna get a whole lot of syrup. But hey, for 100 gallons of juice, if you got 10 gallons of syrup, you were doing good. That much water and everything cooked out of it, you know. And a lot of time he'll tell him, he said, hey, well, he said, the thing you do then, you can stay here from the time your juice go in the kiln till it cook and dip it out, and then you'll see for yourself. Right? That's amazing. A lot of people just didn't want to realize that much water cooked out it, and just that amount of syrup was left.
Mm-hmm. How long would these cane grindings, how long would it last, you know, where people were coming and helping and eating the pork, and how long would that
last? They would cook syrup all day. Like they'll start about 6. Most time they gonna start from the daybreak and they'll cook about dark. But now out on the different farms, it all depends on how much syrup people had. You know, they'll start cooking syrup, say, hey, sometime after Thanksgiving. And a lot of time by Christmas. That's December. Practically everybody be done cooked syrup. Most time, most people will be see because once you strip the cane, cut the tops off it, and cut it down and left it in the field, they put it in pile. But if the frost were going to come, or cold weather, they'll take the fart off the cane and cover it up to keep the cane from getting frostbitten. And then they would haul out the field. They'll go out there and get it. They'd uncover it, then they'd take it to the mill. So he had to go through the mill to crush it to get the juice to cook it. And it was all teamwork. So they'd try to cook it up as quick as they could, but if it was a lot of it, and people had a lot, they'll be in it in November and December. Most time they'll be through with it by December. Sometime, if they had a lot of cane, they might go a little into January, but most of the time, they'll get through in December. And I remember when my dad first started cooking it, we was out there on the Woodbury farm, they was selling it to Susan Johnson and Quincy. And they was putting in 32-gallon wooden barrels. And when they come out there and hauled off the first, he called back out there on the farm and told Mr. Woodbury, that was the white fella that owned the farm, and asked him who was cooking this up. He told me, so we'll bring him over here. He said, well, I need to see him. He said, I can show him better than I can explain it to him. So my dad said, Mr. Woodbury, he had tuberculosis. He didn't do much getting around, but he had a sister out there on the farm with him. She drove my dad to town in Amos, he said, when they got over there to Susan Johnson. So he said, come on in, Dixon, I got something to show you. And my dad said he got 4 20-penny nails. And on them wooden bears, got a hammer and a crowbar. He said he went there to his suet and drove a nail in the bear and it pulled it out to the suet shot out. He had to take a wooden peg and jig in that hole. So he went to another one of his bear and drove a nail in it, suet shot out. He had to drive another peg in that hole. He said, come on, he walked over to some other people's suet. He drove a nail in it, pulled it out. He said he walked away from that bear and drove a nail in another bear and pulled it out. He said then when he walked back to the first bear, he had to wait a few minutes before the suet ever started running out the hole. And then he took and drove the wooden peg in there. He said then they told him, he said, yeah, so your suet is pretty, but it don't have the weight. It's too light. He said not cooked long enough. So then he walked to the other bear. He finally started running out down. So then he said he gave him a tester. And he was in a little tube, a container. Looked kind of like it was made out of tin. Put a little handle on it. But then the tester that went out in there was about 12 inches long. And about like your finger. And as it went up, it had a little round part up there at the top, and it was a little good size larger, but it was red, had a red ring around it. And he told me, when you're cooking your suet, you dip it up, and you put the tester down in there. And he said, when it sank down in there, and when it stopped with that red mark in there, he said, suet. He said, the density is thick enough. He said, then you get A1 like all that surface over there. He said, because this over here is too light and not A1. They were taking it, I believe it was Tomfield. It was either Tomfield or Cairo, Georgia at the time. I think it was Roddenberry where they sold it. He said, now your syrup, you don't have to be cooked again for it to be heavy enough before they can put it in balls and sell it to the market. So it won't bring the top price. He said, nah, if you use this tester, when you bring it all to that mark, they'll get A1, then you get the top price for it. And out of that,
interesting.
He went to cooking it to that, and they had a sister lived out there, one of my aunts, was Aunt Jessica. They had been cooking it by a ton of dipper around him, and the string off the dipper, they said, but syrup. And she told him, say, hey, you ain't cooking syrup, you're cooking honey. But that's what the market wants, you know what I mean? Because before it was just too light.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. I never thought about how much went into that.
Yeah. Here's a technique to it.
When did this start to die out a little bit? I know people aren't doing it like they used to. When did you see a change?
Well, ma'am, it started changing in the 60s. Tobacco business in Gadsden County. One time, Gadsden County per capita, for so many people, was one of the richest counties in the state of Florida. He was more millionaire, they say, in this county from tobacco business. You know, so for every so many hundred people, was a millionaire. And they say, hey, he was more millionaire in this small county by the number of people who was there in the state of Florida. But the tobacco business started going out in the 60s. But I went in the back all through my days in school. Started off what they call a toter. You would carry the back when they'd be primed off the stalk. You'd bring it back to the barge at the end of the field. They'd stack the barge and then I'd take it to the packing. I'd take it to the barn where they were strangling it. And at that time, little children, they'll start off. Hey, you might go out there in the field. You might be 6 or 7 years old. And hey, you might make $1, $1.50 working all day. But at that time, that was good. All right, when I finished high school, when the back went out, when I was last working the back, see, I finished high school in 1958. And I had still worked in the back. And at that time, man that could prime, which like me, or anybody, all the grown men, that $5 a day was big money. Hey, $5 a day, that 5 days you work, hey, you made $25 for 5 days that work. And that was big, big money. Because during high school, them days, hey, if I got that check made that week, when I come home, I gave half of that to my mother. And by the time to go to school, I'd be done bought my school clothes, my shoes, and I'd be saved a little bit. Because my dad, they were strict on that. If you made something, you could spend some of it. But he started all us off young. When we went to working, and out there on the farm, when we was helping him, he would give us so much. And every so often he said, now, all right. He started all off with checking accounts at the Quincy State Bank in Quincy. So now you got to put some part of it in there. And he was going to wait. He wasn't probably actually that week. But the next week, you're going to have to show him that book. And if you didn't take some up there and put in that Quincy State Bank, you had trouble with my daddy. And when he told you something, that was gospel. He didn't tell you it one time neither. Mm-hmm. Now my mama, she was soft and easy going. Now you could talk with her. If daddy wasn't around, she'd give you a break. But if daddy told you don't leave the house, you didn't leave the house. And he meant it. And if you found out you left when he was gone, you had to answer to him. And you didn't want to answer to him because it wasn't no good answer. Because he was finna get that high. Mm-hmm. But I thought he was a hard man. But as I grew up, and I went to see what my friends and associates in the community had, I found out he was one of the greatest things that ever happened to me. He worked us, but he shared with us, and he gave back. And both of them, they were strict. They taught us to respect people, and they taught us to love one another. And during them days, everything, it was segregated. The black was over here, and the white was over there. That was the only thing I never could understand. It was years before I could understand it. But that's the way it was. And a lot of things were denied to us. And a lot of things were took from us. But that's the way it was. And I did a lot of rebelling against it. It caused me a lot of problems.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, it was all segregated, and the one thing, working on the farm, we were around white children. But then after we moved off the farm, moved to town, it was children down the road from us, about 3 miles from us. No, 3, maybe 2 miles. But there was one family down there he had, I think it was 2 daughters. No, 2 sons and a daughter. And they bought 3 horses for their children. But their children couldn't ride them. They couldn't handle them. So we black boys up there, we were up there playing in the street. So he come up there one day and asked us, well, we go down there and help his children ride them horses. And I think at that time, I think I was around 9 or 10 years old. And we go down there and we start riding them horses and them children. And their mother would make a lemonade and give us lemonade and fix sandwiches around there. And we would get around there. They had 3 nice horses. And some of them horses throw one off, another to be that on his back. And we got them horses warm out and got them where we, hey. Now this wasn't an old day. Now this was out of, I maybe say a week or two riding them so much we got where everybody, they were just as gentle as they could be. You could crawl all on them and ride and rub them and brush them and ride them and everything. And sometimes we'll go down there to their house and ride the horses with them. Then sometimes they'll get the horses and come up there where we were at in the black community And then we'll go back down there with them. The mother will fix Kool-Aid and lemonade and give us stuff. And we rode them horses together. Got about 9 or 10. And about 12 or 13. And we were down there one day riding the horses. And the dad had come home. He was just nice to us. He could always had ever been. And he told us, he said, well, y'all, he said, I appreciate y'all coming down here, helping the children. This had went on for 2 or 3 years. He said, well, out of the day, when y'all go home, he said, I appreciate it. Y'all don't come back here. Don't come back down here and ride the horse with the children no more. And I couldn't understand why. So I went home and told my mama about it. She said, well, Bubba, because they always called me Bubba. The Bubba, he said, don't come back down there. He said, I can't tell them other children, but don't you go back down there. And if they come back up here with them horses, you stay away from them. So sure enough, I didn't go back down there. And sometime they would ride them back up there. But if they came up there, and listen to what mom and dad come, I'd go back to the house. If I was out there in the street where we were playing at, and I never did get on them horses no more. I know them, but I just don't understand it. But as I got older, my mom explained things to me. So, well, the girl's getting to be teenagers, so they didn't want you down there no more. So I understood it. And going to school, it was segregated. And that's where I had a problem. Because I knew a lot of these white children. They could go to town, they could be at school, they go all uptown to the drugstore, they could go to the 10-cent store, and go up there and get them some refreshment. But once we go to school, we couldn't leave off the campus. They had a cafeteria in the white school. At Stephen High, we didn't have no cafeteria. They had a snack stand back there. This, you could get 3 donuts for a dime, 1/2 pound of milk for a dime. And then they sold cookies, candy, and drinks in there. But more people would get that milk, 1/2 pound of milk for a dime and 3 donuts for a dime. And I always loved bananas and vanilla wafers. And sometimes I just get tired of eating donuts. And I asked them, could I go across the street? I said, I want me some bananas. They said, no, you can't. I said, well, today I'm going to get them. Y'all do what y'all got to do. And some days I would go across there and get me 3 bananas and me a pack of vanilla wafer. And sometimes I got expelled for school for doing it. But just like I told my mom and dad, hey, I just was tired of eating 3 donuts every day and drinking chocolate. I mean, drinking milk.
Did y'all ever take your lunch?
Well, sometimes you took a lunch, but you know, after you get up in high school, you don't want to be walking to school with no paper sack. You know, when I was in elementary school, yeah, we took it, you know, because we were growing on sweet potatoes. I don't know what, I like the long, crooked one. Had the sweet potatoes in the sack and having some bacon in there, or some sausage, or some ham. And had them dishes with your desk, and you had a little slide thing on it. I had it under there, and a lot of times, hey, get home in class, I'd eat my hands from there, and get a piece of meat, a piece of that sweet potato. A lot of times, teacher said, Dixie, you can't be eating in class if you can't give everybody some, but hey, if they didn't bring a sack, they wasn't finna get none out of that sack. You know, and it was just, some families didn't get out there and try to have enough for the children. But around our house, food was never short. Because my daddy grew garden, and we had plenty to eat. Wouldn't have much, but we had plenty to eat. And it was just a good life for me. And as I got in high school, hey, we grew vegetables. I had a bicycle. And I was selling vegetables in the community. My sister had a bicycle, and she quit riding. So I asked, could I have it? She said, yes. I put a basket on the front. I had one on top of the fender in the back and 2 on the side. And we had stuff like peas, okra, corn, tomatoes. tomatoes, whatever we had in the field, I would get me a little bit, put on my bicycle, and I'd be around the community selling it. And there was an old fella, old black man that lived in the community by the name of Tawana Curry. He seen me one day, he said, Bubba, I said, yeah, sir. I was about 12 or 13 years old at this time. He said, Bubba, he said, you a hard-working young man. He said, and you be around here selling this stuff? He said, I tell you what. He said, well, now when you get your stuff on the bicycle, he said, don't you stop till you cross U.S. 9. And he didn't, that's all he told me. He said, don't stop till you cross U.S. 9. We live side of U.S. We lived on the south side of U.S. 90, about a block and a half from U.S. 90, over in the community where I lived at. Well, but anyway, I got the stuff. Next time I got stuff on my bicycle, and I went up, and I crossed. I wouldn't even come through the community. I stayed on the west, further out, and I went up and I crossed 90. And then I had to go down, go east. After I crossed 90 about a block, I had to go east about another block, a block and a half, before I went to come into to the white settlement. And then the people seen me, and I seen what I had, they were back. And then it come to me. I got cash money. A lot of times when I was staying in the black community, I would let the people have my stuff, but they wouldn't pay me. So then I understood what Mr. Wanda Curry told me. He said, don't stop your bicycle until you cross 90, because he was doing a yard work in that over in the white settlement, cross 90. That's where the most of the white were, bum and hike and all like that. And after that, I just had to tell that him. I would tell him a heap of time, they'd ask me, you got? I'd tell him a lot. I said, we ain't got nothing down there. Because they didn't like that 2 minute time I let them have stuff and they wouldn't pay me. So then, hey, I wouldn't come through the black settlement. I'd stay back and go on across 90 and carry my stuff over there. And, hey, I got the cash money for it, which wasn't much. But, hey, every little bit was a help. Mm-hmm. And then after they got to know me, some of them over there, I started applying their garden for them. Some of them didn't have no garden. My dad had a mule, we had wild. I had plows and a mule and the wagon. And he was plowing garden. Then, hey, after they got to know me, some of them, I went to plowing their garden for them. And a lot of times, I'd go there, I'd break up their land, make up the road, plant the garden for them. And then the seed they have left, they'd give them to me. And I'd take them back home. Give them to daddy. Got to help up with our garden, and it just got to be a thing way here. Mm-hmm. I made some money. It wasn't no big money. And I did that for a year. And then it got way here. As wages went up, wages went to 75 cents an hour. So, hey, if I plow the garden, I get 75 cents for me. 75 cents for a mule, so that was a dollar and a half if I stayed there an hour. But how I like to do it, I didn't want to do it by the hour. I like to do it by the piece. I just like to tell them, say, hey, I'll do it for a dollar and a half, and if it didn't take for 20 minutes to plow, I have the dollar or the dollar and a half and wouldn't have to try to stay there a whole hour to make the dollar and a half. But some of them would rather have. You do it by an hour. So I went to one old lady garden, and she said, well, I'm going to give you a dollar and a half hour, but now you got to work this hour. And I know it was going to take about 20 minutes to plow that little garden. I said, Lord, I must. The plow was already shining, but I went there and I got me a can, and I flattened it on one end, and I stuck it in my back pocket. And every time I go that way, I lay it over and scrape it off. When I go back to the other end, I lay it over and scrap it off. She was out there sitting in a chair by the fig tree. But I wanted to get that dollar in hand, but I had to stay there that hour, so I straightened that plow on each end, which I could apply to God in about 20 minutes. But other than that, I said, I want to get this dollar in hand, so I had to make sure I spent that time. But that's the way it was.
Can you tell me a little bit more about race relations and if that affected how it turned out for you trying to make a living?
Well, yes, ma'am. All right. My mother and father had taught me this, respect everybody. I didn't mind saying, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, thank you, sir. That was just the way of life. And I just got to be honest with y'all. That word nigger. I heard that word so much when I was a boy, he got where it didn't faze me, none at all. A lot of stoves I learned. I don't know why, but the black community was here. There was always a white stove right on the edge of the black community. Now the people run the stove, are most of them treat us real nice. But the people, a lot of people that come in there, a lot of times, every other word come out their mouth was nigger this, nigger this, nigger that. But I learned over a period of time, that word, it didn't faze me. As long as you didn't put your hands on me, you didn't do nothing to me. And I was about 19 or 20 years old before I picked up on something my dad had never told me. But I'd be with him, Ryan. He'd be playing white people God and everything. I'd be riding with him and working out there on the farm together. He didn't call nobody Mr. and Miss. He called all them white folks. And they'd walk up, good morning, white folks. Good day, white folks. Thank y'all, white folks. Well, he always taught me, say, thank you, ma'am, thank you, sir. That was to all grown people, black or white. And that's what I always did. And it opened a lot of good doors for me. But he was hard just the way they treated us. Because everything was separate then. You go downtown, hey, you couldn't go in the bathroom in the stove. A water fountain in there, you couldn't drink from the water fountain. Some of them had white only, but your folks had taught you, you didn't drink from the water fountain. If you want water, if the stove had a bathroom in it, you didn't go in that bathroom. If you want water, if they had an outside faucet, you would have to go out to the outside and stoop down there and catch some water like that and drink it. That was just part of life. And I respected that. I lived with it. I was never in no trouble. I was never had no trouble. I was never arrested till I was a grown man and I had a driving license. And I got arrested for a speeding ticket. But for breaking in and stealing people's stuff, I ain't never broken nobody's house. I ain't never stole none of that, no store. I had friends. Some friends did it, but I didn't do nothing like that. When I went in them stores, hey, if I wasn't able to buy it, I didn't put my hands on it, I didn't pick it up in my pocket. And some of them did it, but I didn't. I never get caught in no trouble. Or at downtown and going to town, a lot of people had pecan trees on the place, and them large paper shears. Because in our community, most we have them little small, what I call fingernails tail up. They was hard, but them white people had them paper shell and the money maker, they was a big pecan. The pecan would fall, and they would fall on the sidewalk and in the streets. But the cars would bust most of them fall in the street. But at that time, coming up in 90, where different places had them nice pecan trees. But if they caught you picking them on the sidewalk, they'll put us in jail for it. So then we got smart. When we leave school, we'll go down there and we'll let three or four girls get ahead of us. And they'll walk, if they were on the sidewalk, they'll take their feet and sweep them on the sidewalk, from the sidewalk in the street, and they'll keep walking. And then we'll come behind them and pick them up out the street. And they didn't never bother long deer that way. And here was this thing you had to learn how to do to survive. All right, in Quincy. 90 go right through Quincy today, the same way. 1, 2, 3. There's three or four streets from 90 north with King Street. Monday through Saturdays, we could go down King Street. We could go to the work. We could rake yards, or whatever we did out there. And now the black people going to work could go down King Street. Sunday, you think black people, the known thing, don't go down King Street. You didn't go down King Street. That's just the way it was. At that time, the black people, they were working in the white community. They were doing housework. They were babysit. They were cooking do for them. But when they went to the house, you always had to go to the back door. Come through the back door, but then you come out there and sweep off the front porch, sweep off the walkway. But you had to go in that back door when you went to the house. You didn't go in that front door. You always went in the back door. And when you got ready to leave the other day, when you knocked off, you didn't exit that front door. You exit out the back door. That's the way it was. Same thing, the cafe. We couldn't go in no cafe to eat. But now, hey, you go to the back door and go in, and they'll fix you a sandwich or whatever. Some of them, all of them wouldn't do that, but some of them would do that. Because all of them, they had black working in it. They were doing cooking and stuff in there, but hey, that's the way it was. We always couldn't go to the front. If you got a little something, you had to go to the back door and get it. And hey, people did it for years. Cause that's the way it was. And if you want to survive and make it, that's what you had to do. All right. In the early 60s, when the wages went to going up, tobacco business, shade tobacco, that's where the biggest money was made in Gaston County, that shade tobacco. Then they say, hey, wages went to say $1 an hour. Gonna have to pay the workers $1 an hour. That's when the tobacco. A lot of them said before they paid Negroes $1 an hour, they were quit growing it. Some of them was growing the tobacco and they had the packing house where they were. What, that's when they chew the tobacco out on the farm and take it that way, you work it up and strip it out and get ready to make cigars and ship it to different places. And a lot of them, they went to closing down because they said before they appeared Negro. Well, I'm using the word Negro. I'm saying just like it was. I'm saying Negro. But they were saying it wasn't no hidden thing. You could be walking or you go in different business. They'll be in there talking about it. Before I pay them niggas $1 an hour, I go out the back of business. And a lot of them did go out. But it was some of them. It wasn't all bad. It was some good white people back then. I worked on a man farm. The Huff farm. And he was a tall man. He was about 6'6". He was a big man. And when him and his white friends come out there, and we got there in the backfield working, and they'll come through there working, they had the water in a keg. They have ice in the keg and had two silver dippers. That was a thing with a long handle, and you could reach in there and get water and drink like that. And out there on his farm, sometimes it'll be him and maybe 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 white friends. They'll come through there looking at the tobacco, seeing the people getting the tobacco. And him thought it'd be hot, 90 and 100 degrees out there in that shade. But he was the only one. I go there and take that dipper. He was a big man, about 6'6", weighed about 300 pounds. They called him the bull. But he'll reach in there, get him a drink of water, drink it, might get two. Hand it all them. you put it back in the bucket. But that the way it was. And you had to learn, if you wanted to make any gas of kind at that time, you had to humble yourself and do the best you could that you could do better. And I went to school, and I tried to do good in school, and I did good. But I had some problems, because like I said, I just didn't understand it. So the second week in the 12th grade, because I had problems, me and the principal there looked like he had a knack of everything I did was wrong. And we was in chapel one day, and he come in. The chapel didn't have enough seats for everybody to sit down. It was girls and boys seated in there, and it was girls and boys standing outside the wall. And he walked up on stage. I called my name, Jewel Dixon. I didn't say nothing. Jewel Dixon, I raised my hand. He said, you get up out your seat and get some young lady to chair. And at that time, I was dating a young lady named Juanita Black from Havana. And I called her and I said, Juanita, she was an answer. I said, Juanita, Rux, she answered. She had a chair. So I told him, I said, when all the other boys get up, when you tell all the rest of the young men to get up and let the young lady sit down, then I'll give up my chair. He wouldn't tell them to sit up, to get up and get his chair. So he told me to come, I got the chair and kid with me. He said, you know, I said, no, I'm not giving up my chair to the rest of the young men that I give up their chair. He told me to go to the office. I took that straight chair and chaired it to the office with me. When chapel was over, he come there, he expelled me from school. I couldn't suspend it, man. I couldn't go back to school no more and got some kind. That was the second 6 weeks I was in the 12th grade. And I wanted to finish high school. My dad and them worked it out of me. I was staying at my aunt in Tallahassee for a while. And then her husband, he was a contrary man. He went to work and she went to work. I went out the door one morning before I went to school. The door locked, slam locked. I went out to grab the paper. I didn't have no key, because I had to go back through the window. So I went back through the window. I just took the stream out. I didn't break nothing, but I got back in the house. Then he wanted to say I broke into the house. But I was out. I just went out there to get in the paper. I didn't have one of my shorts and my t-shirt. I had to get back in the house. So then I took my, I said, Dad, I can't stay there with them no more. So we had a 54 shoelace truck. He let me drove that to Tallahassee and back till I finished school over there. That was in 1953 at Lincoln High School in Tallahassee. And I wanted to go to College Bay. But when we were taking the college entrance exam, it took it 2 days. I took the first half. The second day, I bust the brake line, taking my mother to work at Joel Packing House right there off of 90. And I couldn't go that day because the brakes went out. And I didn't catch. Changed to take the second half for the college entrance exam. So they told me at school, when I went to school the next day, they said, well, I told them, they said, yeah, we know you missed you, wasn't there? So when you get ready to go off to school, they will let you take the other half at college. So when I went to A&M to try to register to go to school, and I told them what happened. But they told me they wouldn't do it. They told me I couldn't take it. They wouldn't do it, give it to me. So I couldn't get in college. So I wanted to go into mechanic engineering, but I couldn't get in. Instead of me going to vocational school, I just was so disgusted. I just got me a job and went to work. I went to work at a meat processing company in Quincy at that time, which was called Frost & Moan. And I worked there about 2 or maybe 3 months, and I liked the job. I was running the smokehouse where I smoked the meat out there. And I had learned to do a good job and was doing it good. But the superintendent of the plant, he was lending money for $25 on the dollar. to pay it off on Friday afternoon. You could borrow money Friday morning, but then Friday evening, you had to pay 25 something on the dollar for you for that money. And he had been at me about borrowing some money. I told him, I said, sir, I don't need to borrow no money. I still own my mother and father. I said, I just don't need to borrow no money. And I didn't throw away my money. So one that day he come in there, he wouldn't be about borrowing money. I wore overhauls, and I kept my money. I had about $500 or $600 up there in my pocket. And he told me, he said, well, so you need to borrow some money. You got a good job, you ought to give something back. So I pulled out my little roll. I told him, sir, I don't need to borrow no money. I can lend some money today myself. And when I went to punch out that evening about 6:30, I was putting in long hours out there, running the smoke out. But when I got there to push out, about 6:30 or 7 o'clock, I didn't have no punch out card, but I had two checks, because he was back a week. So I had my two checks, so hey, I wasn't worried. I said, well, I'm through, but I got both my checks. So I went on. My daddy worked out, he told me, I said, Dad, don't worry about me, I'm all right. I said, I'll survive. So I just got to tell it like it is. So, there's two things that's dangerous to a young person. That's a little bit of money and a little education, and you don't know how to handle it. When I finished high school, I had $3,600 in the Clinton State Bank because I started in the ninth grade in the Fat Stout Show. I showed two steals every year. And plus, I was raising, my daddy was giving us hogs. I was raising a few hogs and selling them. But anyway, when I finished high school, I had $3,600 in the Clinton State Bank. And then when I went to work out there, I was trying to make $100 a week. But by me being single, I was putting a lot of time. I think close I ever got to that $100, about $97 when it take out. But then I was saving my money. So then after he fired me, they fired me out there. I wanted to make some quick money. I just got to be honest, tell the truth in my life. I didn't know how to make it, but I know the friend knows how to make it. But we had did somewhere in school how I still be. So I went to trying to make shine. And my friend, his dad had made it in Georgia. So I had sided up. I had 24 bales in the wood. I made a vat out of sovereigns and tin that would hold 12 bales at a time. And I had 5 gas burners on it. And I could take the juice off of 12 bales and put it in that cooker. And it'd take about an hour and a half, the 2 hours, before it would get to steaming. And then shine would come out the other end of the condenser. And once it get to going, it'll take about 35 minutes. Once it get to going, right, it'll take around 35 minutes. And I'll have a 5-gallon jug. And if I put 12 drums, the juice, the mash off of them 12 drums in there, I'll get about, once I run it and cut it, I'd get about 14 to 15 5-gallon jugs. Because when it come out there, you run it, and every so often you catch some in a half a pint jar. Then you put in the string, let it cool. Then you shake it up. As long as it hold a bead across the top, it was good shine. When it get wet, it wouldn't hold a bead, then you might well cut it off. But then you take somewhat called a low wine, and the other you had to cut it, because that first run would be too strong. Then you had to cut it so it'd be nice and hold a good bead, good, set it for $35 a jug. And I was doing that, and I was helping my daddy grow corn. In the daytime, I'll be out there in the field playing. And I let my friend use my car, because my dad didn't know nothing about this. This was on the cover. And I was liking this young lady in Havana. So I went to go see her that Sunday evening. Plays out there on 12, going to Havana, called Shade of Rest. They pulled me over out there. But I didn't have none on the car. But I didn't know why. So then that Monday morning, I went to see my girlfriend. I stayed out there about 11:30, 12 o'clock. I come on back home. That Monday morning, I got up in Quincy. I went to the Quincy feed mill. I bought some shorts in a 100-pound sack for my hogs and some shell corn in a 100-pound sack for my hogs. And I was coming back up 90 and dug the city, coming to Gridley where my hog was. I put the corn in a bear and wet it and soak it. And the shorts and the bear and with it, that's what I fed my hog with. But you use the same thing to make shine. But you have to put sugar in that. And they put them over in Douglas City. Stopped me again, and I had that on the car. Where you going, shorty? I said, I'm going to feed my hog. So, they looked in my car, didn't have nothing. They let me go. I went up there, put the stuff in to feed my hog. Wherever they come through riding, looked at me, seen me, they went on about their business. So then I said, something wrong. They know something about me. So I went and talked with a friend that told me how to set it up and run and everything. And I was letting this brother, he would help me sometime to get my stuff to take to the woods, but then I'd handle it in the woods by myself. And he said, well, my brother done got two tickets on your car. And I didn't know it. And at that time, you could pay a traffic ticket side of the road. And he paid them, because I was giving him money for helping me. So he said, you want to use my car? I said, no, I don't want to use your car. I don't know what I'm going to do. I said, I'm going to think about it. And this was on that Monday evening. So about that Wednesday, Thursday, I went to him. I said, no, I said, I ain't going back to that steel no more. I ain't fooling no Shine no more. I said, cause I'm not going to jail about Shine. I'm not going to mess up my name and my family name. I'm leaving town. The Sunday before Labor Day, and 5th 8, I left and went to Jacksonville. And I stayed in Jacksonville the rest of 5th 8. And the biggest part of 59. My brother got killed. My brother died in December the 29th of 59. Well, I had come home for Christmas. Well, I was going to leave Jacksonville and go to California, L.A. But my brother died the 29th, and I hadn't left. And after that, I stayed at his funeral, and I didn't leave. And then later on, I got married. I got married April the 9th in 1960. And I was doing construction work. And it wasn't much, but I was doing. But I always loved farming. I wanted to get back to it. So then I bought one new, and I started farming and do a little construction with. I had a few hogs. And right up the road from here, the black lady was Rose Licker. It was Rose Lee Morgan. I think they said they owned, I think it was about 100, 120 acres, but about 65 acres of it clear. And I had one new at the time, when I had been talking with her, and the fella had used the place that year, he didn't pay her the rent. And she asked me, said, you want to farm this place? I told her, yes, ma'am. She said, if you want, it's yours. I said, all right, ma'am. So I didn't have one new. I went out there to Greenbush. Man, they were full locking. I bought me another new. That made me have two. 65 acres. And he had grown corn on it that year. And he made some good corn, but look, ooh, boy, the weeds out there were so heavy. So I'm up there now with these two mules and this mule hair trying to work on these 65 acres. And I was riding the hair and picking up corn, and that mule hair wasn't hard. Them coffee weeds was up, some of them 6 and 8 feet high. It wasn't hard to land them down. So I did that about 2 weeks, trying it. I was, one day I was out there in the field, my mother and father came out there. And when I got to the end, they were sitting there waiting. My dad said, "Bo," he said, "Boy, you know what you're doing?" I said, "What do you mean, Dad?" He said, "You think you're going to be able to handle this place with these two mules?" He said, "Boy, it's a lot of growth on this place." I said, "Well, Dad, I don't know. All I'm going to do is what you taught me. I'm going to work at it. I'm going to get my best." So we talked around there a while, and him and my mother left. I got back on them mules. I ride the hair a while, and I pick up corn, put it in a sack. About a week or two later, he come out there, him and mother. He said, "Get in the car with me." We end up in Bambi, Georgia. He went there and talked with a man at Woodbury Tractor Company. He took him up there. The man had a little Ferguson out there, gas burner 20. A little two-row tractor. Had a tractor, the harrow, bottom plow, cultivators, planter, and a bush hog. It all was used. Excuse me, my dad asked the son, "How you like it?" I said, "Dad, I like it, it's fine." He said, "You want this, yo." So my mother and father, they bought that for me for $2,800. That was in 1960. I want to be a 61. When they brought it down there, I had never been on the track before in my life. But Mr. Woodbury, he brought it down there, and he stayed with me for a while. Told me everything he could about the tractor and the little hair, and I'm there trying to hair with it and everything. And oh, I felt good. I wasn't walking behind two mules. Now I'm on a tractor. And he was a mighty nice man to me. He said, "Hey," he walked around and showed me back. He said, "Hey, anything you don't understand about it, so you call me. And I might not be that day," but he said, "and the next day or two, I'll come down here and do anything I can to help you." And I got started out then. And I took that little track. It was wet. But I got the whole place harrowed down. I harrowed around it. I cut it off in sections. And I got all that vegetation off that old big place burnt up. I took that same little track and harrowed it. And I bottom plowed it. And I planted corn right there. It would work. But I end up getting my job at the Florida State Hospital on the evening shift. I'd work out there in the fields in the morning. I'd quit by 12 o'clock, take me a bath, and I'd go to that hospital and wait from 3 to 11. And I just enjoyed it, and I worked at it. It was wet, but I did it. And I made a pretty good corn crop that year. And I added on to my hogs, and I went to get my few cows. And I can't remember now what the old lady was charging me for that place, but she did me a favor. She would let me have it real reasonable. And I went to add on to the hogs. And I went to get me a few cows. It wasn't fence, part of the fence. And I patched up the fence around it where I could put cows on it. But then I went to using hot wire so I could put the hogs in the field. And it went to getting better and better.
Can you talk about some of the struggles you had trying to make a living?
Well, yes. The struggle was, my dad had taught me to be independent. And in the early 60s, Farmers Home Administration, you could borrow that money. They were lending money for like 2 or 3%. But I didn't want to. He taught me not to go that way. So I just worked it out. I wouldn't borrow no money because they were lending money. And people bought. They were buying land for you. They were building you a home. And a truck, tractor. They were getting through Farmers Home Administration. You could get it all. But I didn't want to go that way. And I didn't go that way. I just worked that. And this land I was tending up there, the one thing they would do back there didn't help you, they would. They would let you have seed and fertilizer to make your crop. Then October was selling up month. Whatever you had to pay, whatever you owed them for your fertilizer and your seed and stuff, you would pay it in October. It was good, but it put you at a disadvantage because in October, when you if you sold your hogs or you sold your corn, the market was down then at the low price. Corn price would be cheap in October and everybody was selling it. But then if you needed some, about May or June, it would be at the top price. And a lot of times, a lot of the farmers, they'd be done sold it all and then had to buy back. But hey, by me working a job and farming too, and I hadn't learned that from my dad, I sold some corn, but I didn't sell it. I sold corn, but I didn't sell it all. And I had learned something else from my dad, and I had experienced it myself. More people in the farming business, black people is what I'm talking about, they tell you too small in it. And over a period of time, I learned you could be too small, you could be too big, and you'd be just right. But most black people stay too small. And what I mean by too small is this. If you're going to farm or any business, you got to produce enough to pay off the cost and leave you something. So you have something left. That's when I know I had to increase my hood. So I went to getting more and more hogs. And I also discovered that what I was trying to do, I couldn't raise enough corn to do what I was trying to do. I had to buy it. So I went from a few sows to a large number. I had 75 sows and 3 bulls. And I had been taking my hog to the auction, but when you go to auction, they sell them for you, but they take out a commission. So then I went trying to take them straight over there to Quincy, to Frosty Mall. And I didn't have to, they might be, you might get a cent less in the auction, but sometimes they'll be paying just as much as the auction. But I didn't have to pay that commission for selling them. So that's what I went to doing. And I was doing that. And instead of me trying to grow corn, because growing it, you got to prepare the land, you got to buy the feed, you got to buy the seed corn and the fertilizer. But with all that, if you don't get a good season, you might not have a good crop if you don't get the water. You got all that in it, but then you still got to buy to take care of them hogs, because that was my biggest crop. Hog was my big money crop. So then what I did, I quit growing corn, period. I was buying all my feed from the Quincy feed mill in Quincy. I had 75 sow, 3 bull, and I would go get like 5 tons of corn. I mean, not five. My truck would hold 7 tons of corn feed. I'd get 7 tons of feed on Monday. Then I'd go back, I'd get 7 tons on Friday. Then the next week, I had about 5 tons. Because from them 75 sides, then I was running like 8. I was keeping like about 800 or 900 head of hogs. That was pigs and big hogs all the time. And I was trying to sell 100 head a month. I had bought that, the old truck still in my backyard. I had bought the international truck. I had a big body on it. I was trying to take 100 head a month to the slaughterhouse in Thomasville, Georgia. Because Frosty Moan had went out of business in Gadsden County. They went out of business. And I was doing real good at it. I was doing real good. I was trying to sell 100 head of hogs a month. And that year, there was in 1980. Hog was bringing about, I think it was in like the 30s. But hog price, you would go up in the hot months. May, June, July, and August. Hog price, you would top out in them hot months. And every day, I would go home, I'd be at my house at 12:30 to listen at the Gene Reagan Farm Show to bring the hog price. Because I was feeding a lot of them, and it got in the 40. I'd be there listening at the farm show. It hit 40 cents that day. I said, oh, Lord, thank you, Jesus. It's moving up. They got on up. A day or two later, 42. I said, yeah, they move. I said, probably going to break 50 this year. I'm going to make some money because I had them. It got about 45. I said, yes, sir, the price is moving up. Boom. Next day, fell like a cent or two. It went back. Every day it was falling back. Fell out the fall. I said, Lord, how much, what it's doing? It got back in the 30s. But I still got all these hogs. I'm still got to go get these feed. I get 14 tons 1 week, 7 tons the next week. Taking hogs off, they're falling back. They won't pay my feed bill. And I said, Lord, how much, what's going on? But it kept falling back. I started selling down. I sold down. I kept 1 pube bull and 5 sire. And hogs had done fell from 40-something cent a pound. Hogs got down to 5 cents a pound. That was in 1980. So I sold all them hogs. I kept 5 young sows on a bull. I thought hog was gonna come back. And I told my wife, I said, well, I quit the state in 65. And it was 8. I hadn't worked no way from 8 or then. I was farming. I said, I got to get my job somewhere and go to work. So I was able to get a job over there at ACI, Department of Correction. And at that time, I owed that feed company $10,500-something. And I went to him and talked with the man, trying to pay him by the month. He said they need the money bad. I said, mister, I ain't got it. You can't get blood from a tunnel. I said, I'm going to do the best I can, but I ain't got it to pay you right now. So he talked kind of hard about it. I said, well, you can say anything you want. I ain't got it. You can't get it. Do what you got to do. But anyway, I went and talked with the Quincy State Bank. And they told me, because I had borrowed a little money from there, they told me, said, Dick said, if you need it, you can get it. So, but if he'll let you pay him by the month, maybe he won't. I said, yeah, they want interest. So they let me have the money at the Quincy State Bank, but I waited till I make sure I got that job at the Department of Correction. Once they told me I had that job and I went to work, I went to Quincy State Bank. They let me have that money, $10,500-something. I went, took it to them, get them a check. They made me receipts that paid in full. I went to work the park correction. Every 2 weeks when I got my check, they had a branch office in Chattahoochee at that time. I go there, cash my check, get them $250. I paid them $500 a month. I left the hog alone. I went strictly to the car. I didn't have many. But I worked at ACI. I raised a few cars. And I worked there till I paid them $10,500. And during the time, I just kept increasing my hood. And I still had the Morgan place up there. So, I don't know how many head of cows I had, but looked like to me, I didn't quite have 30 head. But I had a PUB bull, Black Angus bull. And that year, it was in October. I was hand up, the plant was on the graze. And when I started tending that place, I rented from Miss Rosalie Morgan, but she had a son in Tallahassee and two daughters, one in Bainbridge and one, I think, is in Maryland. And the mother died, Miss Rosalie died. So they were still letting me use the place with the same agreement that I had under the mother. But the lawyer that growed it up, Lawyer Lyon, upstairs in Quincy, over the Quincy State Bank, he told me he brought the agreement. He said, now at her death, this agreement died. So I was just renting it by word of mouth because I didn't have a written lease on it. And the son in Tallahassee, Monroe Morgan, he was handling it. And that year in October, I was getting ready to plant my winter graze, and two white men come there with two hawk trucks, with two hawks on each truck. Two horses on each truck. And I said, where y'all coming? Well, so we bought this place. We come in and put our horses on it. I said, well, sir, I got it rented to December 31st. He said, records, it didn't show nobody renting it. And I lied to him. I said, well, I got a lease. I didn't have no real lease because the lease died the mother. I just rented by word of mouth. But I know, I said, something ain't right. And I tried to call Monroe, which was her son, and I never could get him on the phone. I went up to his house. He wasn't there. Nobody know where he was. So what I did, my mother-in-law, mother and father had their place down there. I went to them. I loaded all my cows up and moved down there on our place. And I put them cows down there. There wasn't no fence around it. I go there every day and check them. They stayed there. I was steady taking down fence and stuff up there and hauling it down there, but I hadn't started putting it up. And I had three fellas help me take down the fence and the pens up there. And I was there one evening about 5 o'clock. David Shad put in there, brought me a letter. Signed by the county judge, you read it to me. That I was to get off that place and don't go back on it. Because Monroe, the man that had been dealing with the son, when I come to find out later, he had a mental breakdown. He was in a mental hospital somewhere. And I never could get in contact with him. So, but I got off the place and I had got my car. I took down all the inside fence, but I left a lot of the outside fence, but I didn't go back on that. I did just like the letter told me. Then about a week or two later, come in one evening, went down there. My cow just walking around. He was out there dead, swole up, feet sticking up in the air like that. So Lord, what's the matter? I went over there to Quincy. I think the doctor's name looked like me, named Dr. Trotman at that time. He come out there and looked. He said, Dixie, he said, I can't say for sure. I can take a blood test, blood from him, we can send it off. He said, I bet them cows got ammonia. He said, I've seen them have it before. He said, a cow can't breathe. Ammonia is white, just like salt. But it be in a bag, in a granular. He said, I bet somebody put some ammonia out here. And out of that herd of cows, I had the cow, the horse, and one little mule in there. I lost all them cows, about four or five she cows and the bull. And the horse and the mule survived. But the rest of them died. But I went to that. I paid that bill at the Quincy feed mill. And now I just got a few cows left. But I don't have that place no more. And then my mother-in-law place, they let me have that. I went to growing a little corn. I had a few cows. I kept working at the state, Department of Correction. And I kept preaching my cowhood. And in a few years, hey, they went to getting bigger and bigger. Then I rented the Macmillan place that joined that. They had 105th acres, which was a 105th acre place, but it wasn't maybe about 7 acres of grass on it. Then the Porter place, it was 400 acres, but it wasn't about, most of that was woods. And it might have been about 6 to 7 acres of grass on that. But then they logged it. They logged a lot of it. And they clean cut it. And they gave me permission to burn and power. And I did that. And I kept increasing my herd in between the Porter place and the Macmillan place. I kept increasing my herd. And till I got up, I had 110 she cows and 3 bulls. And I had all old equipment. But it was working, man. But then when I was able to work, it wasn't no big thing. And I thought I was doing pretty good. The only thing I didn't understand, which my wife was running the grocery store in Chattahoochee. And I was working at ACI and handling them cows out there. And every year, looked like when I would think I done did pretty good, income tax was $10, paying them $7,000 to $8,000. I don't understand this. You know, other people farming, people doing good. And I carried a load of cows off one day to the market up in Donaldsonville, where I sent them off. They come got them. The kid, 33 head of yelling on the trail. And I went up there and I stayed to the sale while they were selling. And I was sitting up there in the auction. And I was sitting beside a white fella from over there somewhere. I don't forget. He was from Dunville. And he seen them went down and loaded them. He said, young man, he said, how you like farming? I said, so I like it. I said, well, the only thing I don't understand. I said, look like when I think I done did pretty good that year, I end up having to pay IRS so much money. He said, and you farm? I said, yeah. I said, well, I'm farming. I said, well, I got a grocery store too. My wife run the grocery store, and I work for the Department of Correction. He said, what kind of equipment you got? I said, well, it's all right, but it's all old equipment. Tractor was old, everything was old. He said, young man, he said, I tell you what you do. He said, listen at me good. He said, don't overdo. He said, if you have a good year and you see that you done did pretty good, he said, you get you a good piece of equipment. I said, all right. So that year, I see my cows that did good and everything. I went to Quincy, Clark Monroe. and I bought me an 80 horsepower tractor. The tractor didn't have a front end load on it, but I told him I wanted it. The tractor was $30,000. To get that front end loader put on it, that was $6,000. And I got that one. And the man, he told me, he said, "Yeah," he said, "that'll help you with your tax for 3 years." So I got it, I didn't know. The man that had been doing my tax, he hadn't told me nothing. So I went to him and asked him about it, but he said, "Yeah, that would help you." I said, "All right." I didn't go, but I didn't let him do my tax no more. I went and let somebody else do my tax. So then, hey, that helped me. I said, "I ain't got to pay nothing back this year." And I kept down for 3 years. And I said, "Well, Lord, I'm doing pretty good." But I was cutting hay in different places.
Yeah.
I could load up in the field with the front end loader on one tractor and bring it home. But when I got over here, I had to pull it off with a rope. And the tractor I had over the farm, I had the back fork on it. Then I could load up and bring home about 30 minutes. It'll take me an hour and a half or 2 hours to unload when I get over here. So I'm going to get me another tractor.
Mr. Dixie?
Yes.
Your wife says that you've got to go to her funeral, and it's 11 o'clock.
11 o'clock?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we ain't gonna leave at about 12. Mildred. Yeah. I tell you what. Yeah. We're going to the funeral at 1 o'clock. When you getting ready, if I don't go, we're going to finish this. You can go if I don't go.
Oh, okay then.
All right.
Well, we'll need to wrap up, too, pretty soon.
All right.
Yeah.
I feel like we could probably come back sometime because you got so many stories to tell.
But it won't take long. But what I was saying, then I went back and I got my another tractor, the first one was an 80 horsepower. But I went back then, I got a 90 horsepower. So then when I cut the hay and roll it, I could leave one big tractor in the field to load it, and I have another big tractor at the house to unload it. And it made things so much easier. And hey, I thought I was in heaven.
Yeah.
I was doing so good. And I had one roller. I had had that roller for years. I said, well, I went and looked at me a roller, a John Deere. It's got a module on it. Put it on the front of your tractor. It's got a computer in it. And you can just set it and make the size of the bell or the warrant. And it show you when it's wrapping it, when it put the string on it, when time to dump it, and everything. Now here to roll some. Hey, I can make a roll, 4 feet wide and 6 feet high. The maximum 6 foot roll. And I could go on a 20-acre field. Hey, I could cut it and rake it by myself. Once it was cut and dry, I could roll it by myself. And you don't start rolling hay about 11 or 12 o'clock. I could do it in 2 days. I get off, I rake 4 rounds. I roll 4 rounds. I rake 4 rounds and I roll 4 rounds. And the reason why I want to rake up so much, so if it rains, if it's flat, it ain't no problem if it get wet. I had a tiller, you can scatter it out, but you didn't have to re-rake it. But then if you get it wind rolled, you know, if you been on wind rolled and it get wet, then it take long to dry it out and everything. Scatter take long to dry it out. But that's why I wouldn't make about 4 rounds, and then I roll it. And I rolled it real quick, and it was great. And I was doing real good. But I was riding across the pasture one day on my tractor. I had a gun rack on the tractor with a rifle. Well, I wasn't there with no hunter, but I would kill a deer. And I seen two deer stop, got my rifle, sighted out on it. I couldn't see nothing through it. I said, dog. Shook my head and did like that. Sighted out again. I couldn't see nothing. I said, something ain't right. I couldn't see nothing through the scope of my rifle. But I could see looking out there. Come on back, parked my tractor, got in my truck, went to the doctor in Chattahoochee. Doctor checked him out. He said, Dixon, you got a problem. I said, what that? He said, your eye pressure. For 35, my right eye and my left eye, pressure was 35 in my left eye and 33 in my right eye. And he said it should have been about 12 or 13. So he started me an appointment at the eye clinic in Dothan, Alabama. And I went up there, they checked him out. In a few weeks, they did surgery on my left eye. And then, at that surgery, I thought I was doing good. Then in a few weeks, they did surgery on my right eye. And then a few days later, my gun and things at the house in the corner. I woke up one morning, I couldn't see my gun. So I called my wife and said, hey, I can't see. She couldn't see nothing. So she called the doctor, took him up there. He said, Dixie, he said, I don't see no why. You can't see. He said, well, hey, the surgery went well. He said, now we got to depend on the Lord. He said, I don't see why your shot couldn't come back. In 6 months, around 6 months, I woke up one morning and I could see a shotgun and rifle over in the corner. I hollered out like a pounder. But it never was real strong. And I got rid of my cows and things, but I kept all my equipment. And my son-in-law, he was in the Coast Guard, and he had about 3 or 4, 5 more years to go. I kept all my equipment because he had already said he wanted to try some cows. And when I was selling them cows, when they were loading them out, 4 she cows on the bull was left. I was still renting the Mac Miller place. I was paying them $2,800 a year for that place. For about 5 years, I paid that rent and kept that place, and I get fellas to go around there, down there with me. And them cows went there, they went accumulating, they went to growing. And then I think I bought about 10. And when he got out the Coast Guard, I had about 64 head down there. So I turned it all over to him. And he tried it about 3 years. And he got out of the cow business. He was a hard-working young man. But he knowed the Coast Guard and I knowed the cow. But I was trying to tell him things, so he was doing it his way.
It was Leroy?
Ma'am?
What's his name?
Leroy McMillan.
It's Leroy, yeah.
So he tried his way. So I backed up and let him do it his way. And out of about 3 years, he got out the cow business. So now I'm there sitting there with a lot of equipment he planted on the garden.
Looks like he had a nice garden.
Yeah, he did, but this year he ain't planting no garden.
Oh, he had something else back there.
I'm just sitting there chilling. I'm taking it easier.
Yeah.
Is all this your equipment that's out here, the heron?
All that stuff. Mm-hmm. See, cause I got a decision to make. Mm-hmm. I don't know when I'm going to make it. I might not make it.
Yeah.
But I got too much tied up in that equipment. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Ain't doing that.
Yeah. And the pens over here. Those
I got that biggest tractor. That was a $39,000 tractor. That's 9 horsepower. That 80 horsepower tractor, it was $36. Then I went back and bought that little small tractor just to rake hay with it. That was a $10,000 tractor. Then I it didn't have wet lines. I had to put wet lines on it sort of pick up the hay rate. So that cost right at another $1,000. So I paid about $11,000 tied in that tractor. Then I went and bought that roller. Finally, looked like me. I got about $27,000 tied in that roller, you know. Mm-hmm. And it just don't make sense to let it all sit there ain't doing nothing. You know, but I ain't made a decision, but if it's mine, I'll make a decision one day. Mm-hmm. And during the meantime, in 2004, I bought me a Ford Dually. That truck was $39,000, and I paid for it on time. But then out of my sight failed me, and I quit driving. So, maybe a couple of years ago, I gave it to him. I said, hey, I can't drive. I don't need no truck like that. Yeah. So I gave it to him.
In the last minute or so, what would you tell somebody? What advice would you give somebody who was thinking about going into farming?
Well, the advice I would give them if they're thinking of going into farming, take your time and think it over good. If you don't love it, don't try it. Farming. You got to love it, and you got to want to do it. Because now, everything is so expensive. Ain't nothing cheap. And then if you're going to go into it, start off on a small base and try to grow. Don't try to go too big at first till you get out there and get some experience at it. And the main thing I would tell any young person gonna try to farm, if you can get all your land in one location, it'll be better if you just get it in one piece. But if you could at least be in the same location, because if you got to spend a lot of time traveling up and down the road going here and yon to field, it takes too much time, it's too much wear and tear, on tractors up and down the road. Them big tires on them tractors, they designed to be on the dirt, not on the pavement. Mm. The pavement will eat them up way quicker than the dirt will. And in the farming business, oil and grease, you got to service it. Oil and grease is cheaper than them parts. Mm-hmm. If you don't service and take care, they'll wear you out. And they don't sell none of that stuff cheap.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time today, Mr. Dixie. You've learned so much.
Mm-hmm. I'm open to try to help anybody.
And we hope that by hearing what, all these people who've been doing this their whole lives, we hope that by hearing what you all have to say about it, that we can help farmers who want to do it in the future and do it better and make a better living at it.
And see, another thing about farming, it's hard to do. But if in the same community, if two or three people or four people, if they could work together and be honest with one another and fair with one another. See, all right, just like I tried to tell the people out here. There were three of us out here with farming. We was all messing hogs and cows. And I tried to get them, I said, hey, let's leave these hogs alone. And let's go to cows. You need three tractors. You need some, you got to cut the hay, you got to rake the hay, and you got to bale it. Y'all were using square balers then. I said, all of us got a tractor. Get a rake, the cutter, the hay. We just go from one field to the other. We all do the outside fences. I ain't got to worry too much about the inside fences, but each one put so many head of cows in there. We all work it together. Then, hey, each one of us got so many cows to sell. You take care of your tractor, I take care of my tractor. But, hey, they didn't do it. Mm-hmm. So I worked and got all the stuff by myself. Then later on, they asked me, the deer. I said, no, the deer ain't good now. I done got in debt and paid for 3 tractors and they got all the equipment. I don't need no help now. And I did most of my work by myself.
Well, we're going to turn off the recorders because I think Adam might need to get some pictures of you.
All right.
Getting some good. I'll get some more and I might get some outside.